Job chapter 28, beginning at verse 12. But where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned, and the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. Where then does wisdom come from? And where is the place of understanding? Thus it is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the sky. Abdon and Death say, with our ears we have heard a report of it. God understands its way. He knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he imparted weight to the wind and meted out the waters by measure, when he set a limit for the rain and a course for the thunderbolt, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and also searched it out. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to depart from evil is understanding. May God bless to our understanding his word. In taking this series of studies from Job, we are endeavoring to understand the issues of life. We need to know what life is all about. So far in our studies, we have considered the question, what is man? We have seen that man is made by God, like God, and for God. We have considered also the question, what is God? And we have seen that God is transcendent, that is, he is above us. He is immanent, that is, he is with us and cares for us. And he is personal. Now, actually, the things that we have covered are really just the basic facts. They are really the bare minimum. On the other hand, they are really straightforward. And because they're straightforward, they really do not require that we give an exhaustive treatment of them. The important thing, at this juncture at least, is that we understand that God is the giver of life and man is the recipient of life. In other words, we have considered the parties involved, but as yet we have not answered the question, what is life? Now, I doubt if any man would have any problem with what we have said about God or man if it were not for the third major question. What is man and what is God are relatively easy questions compared with the third question, what is evil? As one of my teachers, in fact, Dr. John Sanderson, once said, righteousness is relatively simple. It is sin which has made everything so complex. As we come to the book of Job, we read at the very outset that there was a man named Job. And that man was perfect and upright, one that feared God and turned away from evil. Now that really is a tremendous statement. Job turned away from evil. Now, whatever else we might say about evil, the one thing that we need to understand at the outset is that whatever it is that which makes life impossible. In other words, if we could dispense with evil and banish it from the universe, we would all enjoy life to the full. We notice also from this statement that God gave concerning Job that Job was a perfect man. That is an arresting statement too. On what basis does God say that Job is perfect? And I would point out to you that if the character of Job or any other man, you or me, is to be evaluated or judged as perfect on the one hand or evil on the other, it must be made on the basis of some comparison or some measurement. During the years that we were in Australia, we experienced the transition from the use of imperial weights and measurements to the metric system. To say the least, it made us acutely aware of how much weights and measurements are part of our lives. We experienced the frustration of being forced into situations continually where we had to make calculations on measurements with which we had no experience and with which we were not familiar. Though the government tried to legislate against it, there were many who took advantage of those who were bewildered and confused. And we joked about the fact that it was the poor farmer who suffered the most. In changing from acres to hectares, the size of his property decreased by more than 50%. In changing from miles to kilometers, it doubled the distance to the market. In changing from gallons to liters, it took four times as much fuel to get to the market. And then, of course, to top it all off, in changing from pounds to dollars, it doubled the size of his mortgage. Well, that's the one side of it. There were some benefits. It was a boost to a person's morale to discover that his savings account or his insurance policies and things like that had suddenly doubled. For some, it was a pleasant surprise to wake up one morning and to discover that they weighed only half as much as they did the day before. And it felt great to be able to drive down the highway at 100 without having any sense of guilt. On the other hand, there's no telling what some families had to eat when the cook had to adjust to grams and liters. It was rather disconcerting to find that one's waistline had gone from 36 to 200 plus. And it was rather strange to find oneself sweltering in 40 degree temperatures. Well, we can joke about it now, but it was frustrating at the time. And as I said, it made us acutely aware of the importance of measurement in our daily lives. We're constantly making measurement judgments. We look outside and say, what a beautiful day it is. It must be 80 degrees. We comment about the rain that we've had and we say, well, we must have had about half an inch. A mother goes into the store and she holds up a garment and she says, yes, that will fit him, thinking of her child. We give directions to someone and we say, go down there 2 or 3 miles to a certain point. We meet someone on the street who asks us the time, and we look at the sun and we say, well, it's just about noon. Now, the reason that we are able to make these kind of judgments is because, and to do so with a degree of meaning, is because we have a mental picture. When I say that something is about a foot long, I think in terms of the ruler on my desk. When I think of a pound weight, I think of a pound of butter. We used to buy butter when I was a kid in a pound block, and that was, you know, a pound of butter. When I think of an hour, I think of a church service. Well, maybe that'd be better illustrated some other way. But we constantly are called upon to make measurement judgments. Sometimes, of course, greater precision is needed. We find that our judgment is not good enough. To determine an hour, we look at our watch or our clock. To measure an object, we find that ruler, that yardstick, or that tape measure. To buy the vegetables at the supermarket, we rely upon the scales. And were it not for these and many other instruments that we use daily, we could not live very well-ordered lives. School would probably never start if the children just guessed the time. Our properties would not be very secure if we just guessed the boundaries. Our highways would be exceedingly dangerous, and more dangerous than they are, if people just guessed their speed. We depend upon all kinds of measuring devices. We find them, in our modern world at least, indispensable. But in spite of that, most of the instruments that we use are not particularly precise. They are not the kind of instruments that we would use if we were going to build a spacecraft. For that, there must be tremendous precision. There must be tremendous accuracy. Now, as you know, a spacecraft is built all over the country. There are factories in probably most of the states that produce something that goes into a spacecraft. And each place makes a particular part, and when all of those parts come together and they are fitted together, they fit with precision. They fit because they are all measured according to standards of measurement which are acceptable. It would be incredibly confusing and utterly impossible if every factory that produced a part for that spacecraft set its own standards. They are able to operate with precision because they operate upon standards which have been set by the Bureau of Weights and Measurements. Similarly, the time of day is set not by each country, not by each state. It is set when the sun passes over a particular point in Greenwich in England. And that is our reference point, no matter where we are in the entire world. Now, I've taken a lot of time talking about measurement, and I've done so to impress upon you how important measurements are to us, and to remind you that whether we are stepping out a rough baseball diamond at a picnic, or measuring the site for the building of a building, or building a spacecraft, ultimately we are appealing to an absolute standard that is kept at the Bureau of Weights and Measurements. We find it essential to appeal to those standards in every area of our physical life. In light of this, it is utterly incredible that when it comes to the deeper issues of life, when it comes to matters of ethics and morals and human behavior, people operate as though no standard exists and that as though no standard is needed. When God says that a man is either perfect or he is evil, it is not just an arbitrary fancy or a whim on the part of God. It is not just a matter of personal choice. We live in strange times. We are told that war is immoral by people who build private arsenals in their basements. We are told by some that killing whales is murder, but abortion on demand is what is needed. A few years ago, it was fashionable to protest bombs in North Vietnam by people who provided bombs for North Island. There are many people who get all excited and worked up about the pollution of our environment, and rightly so, I suppose, when at the same time, however, they encourage people to pollute their minds. To the modern mind, there is no inconsistency here. Because in the modern thinking, everything is purely relative. There are no standards, and therefore one's ideas can be whatever way the wind happens to blow. And our modern world tells us that it is only a matter of personal likes and dislikes. One is free to adopt whatever position he desires. There's only one fly in the ointment. If there are no absolute standards for morals and behavior, a person cheats when he says that war or anything else is immoral. Nor can he say that abortion or anything else is right. If everything is purely relative, there are no rules. There are no standards for moral judgment. There is no such thing as right and wrong, good or bad, true or false. There is no such thing as moral or immoral. Now, of course, no one can live that way. Sooner or later, a person must find a standard. Sooner or later, he must come to some sort of understanding of something that is going to regulate his behavior. Where do people turn to find standards for morality and behavior? Well, some turn to the world of nature. If one obeys the laws of nature, natural laws, if one eats the right food, gets sufficient exercise and proper rest, good fresh air, he will be able to enjoy life. If one can only escape all the anxieties of modern living and the pressures of the 20th century, he will find the good life. This is the path to the good life, we're told, and it will dictate what is right and wrong. In other words, morality is dependent upon natural laws. Several years ago, I sold a small piece of property I had inherited, and I regretted the sale after I learned that a group of hippies had bought it for a commune. They were going to live the good life. They were going to live close to nature, and so they had a few goats and some chickens and a small garden. And for a time, everything seemed like it was going well. They had escaped the rat race. One day, all their dreams were shattered. Their leader went out and committed suicide. The answers to life are not found in nature. We cannot find an adequate standard for morality and human behavior in the laws of nature. That's one alternative. A second alternative is some people appeal to an individual. In some places, it is the fad to follow the latest guru, but I might point out that it is not restricted to those who are far out in their thinking. It can apply to the most conservative people as well. I suppose we all have our gurus. It certainly is true of the cult. The cults who derive their ethical and moral standards from some individual who claims to have a divine inspiration. The Mormons follow Joseph Smith. The Jehovah's Witnesses follow Judge Russell. The Seventh-day Adventists look to Ellen White. The Christian Science movement depends on Mary Baker Eddy. And we could go on and on. Including the major religions of the world. The religion of Islam, for example, follows their prophet Muhammad. while Christians follow, claim to follow Jesus Christ, we are not immune from having our evangelical gurus either. In some circles, Scofield, Hal Lindsey, Charles Swindle, Robert Schuller, and any number of other men speak with more authority than the Bible itself. They're not the only ones. That's not necessarily a criticism of the men, criticism, however, of those who follow them blindly. But on what basis? On what basis or on whose authority does one individual say that this is right and that is wrong? On what basis do they say that this is what a man should do and on the other hand say this is what he should not do? There are many wise men in the world, but we need a better reference point than a self-appointed prophet or an individual opinion. Nor is it adequate for a person to set his own standards, to do what is right in his own eyes. We must have a standard which applies to all men at all times, under all circumstances. We must look beyond man, no matter how good he might seem and how appealing his ideas might be. That's a second alternative. A third alternative, which is probably a more popular, is the majority opinion. Since everybody is doing it, it must be right. A company in South Carolina used to advertise with the slogan, 1 million South Carolinians can't be wrong. Can't they? That is an appeal, you see, to majority opinion. But is that adequate? If we accept the biblical proposition that all men are sinners, it is a false conclusion to assume that the opinions and standards of men in general are right. There must be something more reliable by which we can determine our standards for morality and behavior. I remind you that the Apostle Paul says that those who measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves among themselves are not wise. For life to be meaningful, it must be consistent. To be consistent, it must be based upon an unchangeable and unchanging standard. It must apply to all men at all times under all situations. When the Westminster Divines defined God by saying that God is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable, they were saying something of tremendous importance. They were saying that we have a God who is always there and a God who is always the same. And because God is unchangeable in his holiness, justice, goodness, and truth, we have a moral standard which is absolute and which is completely reliable. And because God is unchangeable in his moral attributes, he is the absolute standard by which we must measure ourselves. And it does not matter at this point whether a man stands in grace or whether he stands in sin, he must measure himself according to the ultimate standard, namely the character of God. The character of God is the standard by which we must all measure ourselves, to which we are held responsible, and to which we can appeal. If this absolute standard is removed, as many men have tried to do, we are in a comparable situation of trying to build a spacecraft where every piece is engineered according to different standards. Remove the standards, and there is no basis for saying this man is perfect and that man is evil. Remove the standards, and there is no basis for approving this man and disapproving that man. There is no basis for praising this man and blaming that man. remove the standard, and all human responsibility is gone. All concepts of right and wrong, good and bad, morality and immorality, justice and injustice, truth and falsehood, love and hate, and all other moral and ethical ideas are meaningless outside a framework of absolute standards. There is only one way for God to measure Job. He measures him by an unchangeable standard, and that standard is his own unchangeable character. Our catechism asks the question, what do the scriptures principally teach? And the answer is, the scriptures principally teach what man is to believe concerning God and what duty God requires of man. Now you will observe that in that answer there are two parts. What we are to believe concerning God and what we are to do, our duty. The scriptures teach us what we are to believe concerning God. In other words, we are not at liberty to form our own opinions about God. We are to believe what God has revealed to us in this book. He is the standard, and it is a standard that we are not at liberty to change. That is why idolatry is such a serious business. Idolatry or images have their origin in the imagination. And the imagination, you see, can change, alter the standard. God is the standard. The scriptures reveal the true standard, namely the character of God. In keeping with that standard, the scriptures teach us also what our duty is. In other words, our appeal to the scriptures is an appeal to the character of God. And it is our appeal to the character of God that must regulate our behavior. Now, I've taken a long time this morning on this because it is so basic and it is so important, especially in our modern day. In fact, it is so important that I probably will take another two messages on the subject. And I'm aware that having talked at length along this line, I have scarcely mentioned Job. And as you become aware, no doubt, this is a series from Job rather than a series on Job. But to summarize the message, I want to say again that if a man is to be evaluated as either perfect or evil, he must be measured according to the character of God as it is disclosed for us in the scriptures. Now then, I want us to take just a few moments to consider a few statements to see how this fits into the life of our friend Job. God says that Job was a perfect and an upright man who turned away from evil. What was Job's standard? Did he measure himself according to the character of God as it is revealed in the Word of God? Well, in chapter 21, and you might look at some of these references with me. In chapter 21 and verse 7, Job asks, "Wherefore do the wicked live? Wherefore do the wicked live?" Or we might ask, on what basis do the wicked live? I think that's the intent of the paragraph. Then come down to verse 14, chapter 21, verse 14. "They," the wicked, "say unto God, depart from us, for we desire not the knowledge of your ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him, and what profit should we have if we pray to him?" That's the attitude of the wicked towards God. And as one looks at the intervening verses, it is clear that the standards of the wicked are wealth, prosperity, happiness, and power. There is no place in their thinking for God. You'll recall that the psalmist says in the first verse of the psalm, Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. The counsel of the wicked, you see, is in terms of prosperity and power. Verse 16 of this chapter, Job recognizes that their prosperity is not in their hands. In verse 17, you will notice he goes on to say that the lamp of the wicked will be put out. And in verse 18, he says, they are as the chaff that the storm carries away. In other words, Job sees the folly of living according to the standards of the wicked. He put that kind of counsel aside. He repudiated it, is the word. On the other hand, I draw your attention again to his statement in chapter 23. Chapter 23, verses 11 and 12. Where Job says, my feet have closely followed his steps. I have kept his way without turning aside. I have not departed from the commandments of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. Job was a man who walked with the Lord in the light of his word. Consider also chapter 28 and verse 12. Where Job asks the question, where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? Man does not comprehend its worth. Verse 15, it cannot be bought with the finest gold. Verse 20, he asks the question again, where then does wisdom come from? Verse 23, God understands the way to it, and he alone knows where it dwells. Verse 28, and God said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. My dictionary defines the word wisdom as the power to make the right decision and to follow the soundest course of action. Job tells us that the right decision, the soundest course of action, is to fear the Lord your God with all your heart. In other words, he regulated his conduct, he measured his life alongside the character of God. That is the path of wisdom. That is the path of understanding. And it is on that basis that God looks at Job and says, there is a perfect and upright man who shuns evil. Let me ask you this morning, what is your standard? Are you like so many people in the world and compare yourself with others? Or do you compare yourself with God? We appeal to absolute standards, or as near as we can do have them. We appeal to absolute standards when it comes to the time of day and when it comes to laying out a baseball diamond. What fools men are who reject the only absolute standard for life and conduct.